Good evening, everyone. We're having a special class on Megillat Esther. And in order to understand Megillat Esther, we have to introduce the story with a little bit of Jewish history. So our story begins with creation. God creates the world from the pinnacle, from the apex, from the highest point, from the Holy of Holies. And just as the Holy of Holies, according to our tradition, was the first piece of land that was created and everything else emanated from there, so too, much of world history revolves around what's going to happen in that little segment of earth where we had our Temple Mount. So, be it the Crusades, be it the First Temple, Second Temple, be it the trading that happened through the land of Israel, much of what goes on in world history, Yaakov and Esau's wars, some of the wars with Egypt, revolve around that, call it trading route, but that cherished land, Eretz Kena'an, the land of the traders. To trade is Kena'ani, is a trader, one who does trade. And our Megillah is no different, where our Megillah, Megillah's Esther, is really focused to a large extent about that piece of land, what's going to happen with the temple. In order to understand that, we will look at the book of Daniel. But we need a few more points of introduction. The book of Esther was written under Ahasuerus. And in the Holy Shlah, he writes that Mordechai's work was reviewed by Ahasuerus. And the book became a book of Persian history. So this is one book, which is our book, but it's a book that's going to be read by the nations. So if Mordechai would write the book of Esther the way he wanted to, if he would write, and God made this happen, and God made that happen, what would the Persians do? In their history books, they would take Megillas Esther, take out God's name, and interject their idol's name. And so therefore, Mordechai writes the book of Esther with many allusions. The whole book is Esther is hidden. And we will see that there are so many themes and so many messages in the book of Esther that cannot be written overtly. Because there was constantly a concern that the nations shouldn't feel, Ahasuerus shouldn't feel, that we were rejoicing their downfall. We were rejoicing the fact that we were saved from annihilation. But the way Mordechai words the book of Esther is with great care, not to get everyone upset at us. Mordechai knows that he's writing a book, Mordechai and Esther. They're writing a book which is going to be our book, but it will also be the book that the Persians use as part of their history.
And they do?
I don't know if they do today, but the Megillah attests at the end of the Megillah that this is, we'll see. We'll see the last verses of the Megillah. They clue us into what's going on there. So that's why God's name never appears in Megillah's Esther. The whole Megillah has hidden messages that Mordechai can't spell out. And in order to understand the Megillah properly, we need to understand the history, what happened before Megillah's Esther, and what was bothering Ahasuerus when his reign began. What was he trying to rectify? Like every politician, there are at least two meanings to every sentence he says. There's what he wants everyone to hear and what he's really trying to accomplish. And as we go through the Megillah, we'll see that time and again. Yes?
Just so on the subject of the Persians using the Megillah as history, it's funny because Ahmadinejad, a few months ago, made a whole speech about how the Israelis needed to pay reparations for the Purim massacre of the Iranians. So they do use it as history in some way.
That's unbelievable.
So our story begins with we began with creation, and we fast forward 2448, we leave Mitzrayim, and in the year 2448 years after creation, we leave, have a prophetic vision of Oz Yashir, where in that prophetic song of Oz Yashir, we sing about, Tevi'eimo, bring them, betite'eimo, behar nachalatecha, Machon Leshivtecha, we're waiting for Hashem to set up His place, His home, which is the temple. And then we really continue moving forward in Jewish history until we build the temple. We have the Assyrian Empire attacking from the north. We fast forward to the end of the period of the first temple. the Syrian Empire enters from the north, makes a pact with the northern 10 tribes. First the Aramean Empire makes a pact with the northern 10 tribes as they attack Judea, and they are unsuccessful. And God warns them that they will be exiled and not us and not Judea. And then the Assyrian Empire swoops down on the northern 10 tribes. And after three attacks, the first attack, they exile 2 tribes. The second attack, 2.5 tribes. And finally, in their final attack, they exile the remainder of the 10 tribes. And what's left is Judea. And then the Assyrian Empire figures that's easy takings. They come and they surround Jerusalem. And they bring so many soldiers in their army that they dry up rivers as they cross them. The hooves of the horses and the feet of the men dry up whole rivers as they cross those rivers. And they come and surround Jerusalem. Yes?
What does it mean to exile them?
They took millions of people who lived in the northern 10 tribes and on the eastern side of the Jordan. And according to one understanding, they brought them to a far out island somewhere in Africa. That was the Syrian method of ensuring that people didn't rebel. Whenever they'd conquer a people, they would exile them. And this way the people would be so busy trying to get their bearings. Imagine a person is exiled from Israel to China. So he has no idea what food he eats in China, how he deals with the agriculture in China. The last thing he's thinking about is rebelling against the king. Because he has to work so hard to make ends meet. And then what happens is that the next generation already grows up with the understanding, this is where we live and this is our king and we're under the Assyrian Empire.
Was it slaves?
So some were sold into slavery. Many were sold into slavery. Many intermarried. And then others were also taken to this far out island.
So it took like thousands and thousands.
Millions.
Of people,
millions. Maybe 10 million.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably the greatest Holocaust of Jewish history.
And what were they trying to accomplish?
They were conquering territory, and they were getting peoples. They took people they conquered in the island of Crete, and they brought them into the land of Israel. And then they had to cultivate the land of Israel and pay taxes. And now the Syrian Empire was expanding its hold. So they lay siege on Jerusalem, and as they lay siege, they get word that the Egyptian Empire has attacked them. So they leave, and they leave word to the king of Judea, don't think that you're saved. You're going to tell your people, God took care of us. No, I'm going to defeat the Egyptians and come back for you. And that's exactly what he does. He defeats the Egyptians, and he comes back to conquer Jerusalem. And he surrounds Jerusalem, and there is a famine in Jerusalem. And there is no, we don't stand a chance. And he tells the king Chizkiyahu, he says, I'll give you as many horses as you want. You don't even have riders to put on the horses. I'll give you just one battalion of mine if you want to come fight me. What nerve, you think you're going to stand up to me? And that night, the prophet Isaiah tells Chizkiyahu, don't worry, things are going to work out. And that night, a plague hits the camp of the Assyrian Empire. And over 100,000 soldiers dropped dead in one night. Our tradition is that the angel came in and allowed the people to hear the songs of the angels in heaven. And when they heard that, they dropped dead, whatever that means. So at any rate, all the soldiers that were surrounding Jerusalem die, except for one. And his name is Nebuchadnezzar, a midget, one amatul, little man, but very brave warrior, very powerful warrior. And he walks away, having seen the great miracle as he stood at the gates of Judea, having seen how all his comrades fell with no explanation. And he builds up his backing until he becomes king of the Babylonian Empire and conquers the Assyrian Empire. He takes over the Assyrian Empire, conquers their capital of Nineveh, and that's the first year of his reign. The second year, he comes back for Jerusalem, and he succeeds. And he conquers the Judean king, Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim is subservient and pays taxes for 3 years. And he makes Jehoiakim promise he won't rebel. Jehoiakim keeps his word for 3 years. After 3 years, he rebels. And he spends 3 years in his rebellion until finally Nebuchadnezzar comes back and conquers him. And now we're holding at year 8 of Nebuchadnezzar. He kills Jehoiakim for rebelling against him and takes Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiachin, and establishes him as king of Israel. He goes back to Babylon and his advisors tell him, what a stupid thing. If the father couldn't be trusted, you're trusting the son? That's not the way to do it. So Nebuchadnezzar comes back from Babylon to Israel the next year, in the 9th year of his reign. He re-enters Judea. He catches Jehoiachin, the Judean king, and takes him to exile. But he wants to ensure that there will not be another rebellion. So what he does, in his mind, is to weaken the Jewish people, but in truth, he does us the biggest favor in Jewish history. He takes all the rabbis and leaders of Judea and exiles them to Babylon. Now, how is that a favor to us? His thoughts were, if I take out all the leaders, so then they won't rebel against me. In truth, being that a short time later, a decade later, we're all going to be exiled into Babylon, so what happens is that all those rabbis and leaders were there a decade earlier. They established yeshivas and shuls, and by the time we came out to Babylon, we had a whole Jewish system set up for us. So Nebuchadnezzar thinks he's hurting us. In fact, he set up the greatest institutions in Babylon to the extent that even great leaders like Ezra wouldn't leave Babylon when it came time to rebuild the temple. They said, there's so much Torah out in Babylon, what am I going to Israel for? So he really set up an epicenter of Torah in Babylon by exiling all the rabbis and all the leaders 10 years before the great destruction of the temple. So in his 9th year, he exiles Jehoiachin and takes his nephew Mattaniah and establishes him as king, and he tells him, promise me you won't rebel. Now one day Mattaniah walks into a room and he sees Nebuchadnezzar eating a rabbit alive. Now, even among the nations, that was something that everyone would scorn at. Like, how could you eat an animal alive? It's one of the Noahide laws, kill it and then eat it. So Nebuchadnezzar is very embarrassed. He grabs Tzidkiyahu and threatens to kill him. And Tzidkiyahu takes a vow that he won't reveal Nebuchadnezzar's secret, that he eats animals alive. Now, Mattaniah, he changes Mattaniah's name to Tzidkiyahu. The nephew, Mattaniah, the nephew of Jehoiachin, he establishes him king and tells him, Sitki yo, tzedek, righteousness of God, will be between me and you. Now why is it that Nebuchadnezzar merited to be king? We're going to see he was king over the whole world. No empire stood up to him. Everyone paid him taxes. Why? So our tradition is that one time he was the scribe of the king, and the king sent a letter to the king of Israel, and he wrote, I'm writing this letter in honor of the king of Israel and in honor of the God of Israel. Now that day, Nebuchadnezzar wasn't around to write for the king. So he had a day off. So the substitute scribe of the king wrote it that way. And the next day, Nebuchadnezzar comes to his position and he reads the copies, the carbon copies of what the letters that were sent out. And he looks at the substitute scribe and says, you dope. How do you write that? In honor of the king, in honor of the God. The God of Israel comes before the king of Israel. And then the substitute scribe tells him, well, the messenger just left. You could catch him. So Nebuchadnezzar, out of respect for God, gets out of his seat and runs 3 footsteps to stop the messenger. Then he realizes, forget it, I'm not going to catch him. But he took 3 steps to catch that messenger. Our tradition is that in merit of those 3 steps, that's why he merited to be king over such a huge empire. And according to some, that's what we're alluding to when we take 3 steps towards our Shmoneh Esrei. We take 3 steps forward in our Shmoneh Esrei. It's not the 3 steps back, it's the 3 steps forward. Like Nebuchadnezzar took 3 steps in honor of God, we're taking 3 steps forward. So Nebuchadnezzar appoints Mattaniah as king and changes his name to Tzidkiyahu. And he says, God should judge you if you ever reveal my secret. God should judge you if you ever rebel. I'm leaving you here to take care of the Jews. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar takes the leaders into exile, he also takes the children of the monarchy, the children of Judea. And among those children are 4 children, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And he takes them into his quarters, he castrates them, he makes them into eunuchs, and he gives them 3 years of education so that they would be able to serve him as advisors. Now, that's the prophecy that we read in Isaiah, when we read every fast day, Val Yomar HaSari Sein Ani Etz Yavesh. The eunuch shouldn't say, I'm a dry tree, I have no fruits. Ki Cho Amar Hashem, Hashem says, you eunuchs, you should know, your deeds, your keeping Shabbos, they are going to be Yad Vashem, they are going to be your name in the future. And the truth is that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, those four children from the Judean family, from the family of the kings, the four of them were castrated as a punishment. When we learn the book of Kings, we'll still see why they had to undergo that. So he takes these children, brings them into his palace, and gives them 3 years of education so that they would be his advisors. Let's fast forward a decade. We're holding the 19th year. What do you think Tzidkiyo did? He went and got his vow annulled. He went and told people how he saw Nebuchadnezzar eating a rabbit alive. He went and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. He did not listen to the prophet Jeremiah Yirmiyahu, who told him not to. He did not listen when the Navi Yirmiyahu told him, you will be taken into Babylon, but you won't see it. He figured, what does that mean? Tzidkiyahu assumed he had a tunnel under the temple. He had a tunnel under his palace that led him outside the city. And he figured, whatever happens to the city, no one knows I have this tunnel. I'll take my kids and I'll run out of the city. And that's what he does. In the last moments of the destruction, he flees in the tunnel. But God had warned him, you're not going to escape. So when Tzidkiyahu comes out of his tunnel, God causes a deer to come running by. Not just any deer, a deer that the Babylonian officers were chasing after. So the Babylonian soldiers are trying to hunt this deer, and they bump into Tzidkiyahu and all his kids. Tzidkiyahu and his family, who thought they were scot-free. Here they were in this barren forest, but God had warned him, you're going to get caught, you're not going to escape. And he's brought before Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar starts yelling at him, how could you? You promised. And then, that story we'll expand on Bezrat Shem as we prepare for Tisha B'Av. He punishes Tzidkiyahu. He slaughters all of his kids opposite his eyes, and then gorges out his eyes. So the last thing he saw was his kids being killed, his own family. He proceeds to torture Tzidkiyahu and exile him. And Tzidkiyahu weeps as he enters Babylon. He says, this is what the prophet warned me. I would enter Babylon, but not see Babylon. And then Nebuchadnezzar throws Tzidkiyahu into a dungeon, where Tzidkiyahu is going to remain for most of his life. The final years of his life, we'll still see what happens. So in his 19th year, that's when Nebuchadnezzar does all of this. In his 21st year, so by now, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, these four kids are no longer kids. Remember, a decade has passed since they got that education. So let's say they were 9 and 13, so now they're 23, they're young men. And Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Now, in his dream, he sees a tremendous idol, where the head is made of gold, the chest is made of silver, the center, the torso down is made of copper, and then earthenware mixed with copper. And in his dream, a rock comes flying down and crushes this whole great idol into a little piece of chaff, you know, the chaff off of the kernel. And a wind comes and blows away the chaff, and that whole giant idol, which filled up the whole screen of his dream, the vision of the dream, that whole giant idol ended up being this little piece of chaff blown off by the wind. And then the rock becomes a huge mountain. And he wakes up and he can't figure out what the dream means. So he calls in, he can't remember the dream, nor can he figure out what it means. So he calls in all his advisors and he says, okay, I had a dream and I want you to tell me what my dream was and what it means. So the advisors say, okay, tell us the dream, we'll tell you what it means. And he says, oh, I forgot the dream. You tell me the dream and tell me what it means, and then I'll know that your interpretation obviously is right if you figure out the dream too. So they say, well, we told you, tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means, because no one can tell you what you dreamt. So he says, what a chutzpah, I told you I forgot the dream. What are you asking me to tell you the dream? You guys are a bunch of liars. Why can't you tell me the dream? So they say, wait, there's no human who could possibly tell you the dream. There was once a human who could, but not anymore. He says, what do you mean? They say, well, there was a temple, and in the temple you had a high priest, a Kohen Gadol, who wore a breastplate, and he had God's spirit in him, and he could tell you what the dream meant. But you destroyed all of that. So he looks at them and says, you advised me to destroy all of that. No. And he orders to have, he tells them, you have until nightfall to tell me the dream and interpret it. And then he orders all his wise men to be killed, to be slaughtered. So his executioner is going around killing all the wise men. And he comes to Daniel's house. And Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah there together. Daniel asks him, what's the chutzpah? What's going on here? What are you killing everyone for? So he tells him the story. So Daniel says, fine, go to the king and tell him he should give me until tomorrow. Let's see if I can get him an answer. So he asks Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to pray on his behalf. And that night, he is told the dream. And he wakes up in the morning and he says, Yehei Shmei Rabo Mivorach Lolam Lomei Omaya. Where do we get that from? That's here. You can see it in Pasuk Chof, in what's called the second chapter. Daniel calls out and says, may the name of the God be blessed from this world to the world to come, that wisdom and might is His. He's the one that changes the times. He's the one that removes kings and establishes kings. He's the one that gives wisdom to the wise men and knowledge to those that understand. He revealed the secrets to me. He knows what's in the darkness. The light rests with Him. To you, the God of my fathers, I thank and I praise you, the wisdom and might that you gave me, and now you let me know what I asked you, the thing that the king forgot. Daniel runs to the executioner named Arioch, and he tells him, stop killing all the wise men. Bring me to the king, I have an answer. So Arioch quickly brings Daniel up to the king, and he tells him, I found one of the Jews who's going to tell the solution to the king. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar took these four kids as his advisors, he changed their names. He changed Daniel's name to Belshazzar. What does Daniel mean? I will be judged by God. What does he change his name to? Baal, that's the pagan god of the Babylonians. His name is Baal. Shazzar means wisdom, meaning the wisdom of this young man comes from my idol, Baal. That's what he changes his name. Belshazzar. So Daniel is brought in before the king, and Daniel says to the king, notice, like Yosef, he adds his own spice to the interpretation. He doesn't leave it with the interpretation alone. He tells him the secret that the king asked for, no wise man or sorcerer could tell the king. But there is a God in heaven, and he knows all the secrets. And he is the one that revealed to the king what's yet to come throughout the world. He's revealed to you what's happening in this world till the end of time. And the thoughts that you keep having, what's going to happen with your empire, where's the world heading to, that's what the God in heaven answered you. And now I'll tell you. The dream that you dreamt of this huge idol that was seen to great distance, the head of gold, that's you. The chest of silver is the next empire that's going to control the world. The torso of copper, that's the following empire, and the feet of earthenware and lead, that's the final empire. And when it's all done, there's going to be a Messiah, and he's going to come down, and the Jewish people will regain their position in the world. And all these kingdoms will seem like they were of no importance, and that's the chaff being blown away. And everyone will realize the way to service Hashem, and that's the idea of the stone becoming this huge rock, that the knowledge of Hashem will spread throughout the land. This is what you were worried about, and this is the solution of the dream. Nebuchadnezzar falls and bows before Daniel. When he hears Daniel's interpretation, he hates Daniel. He doesn't like that interpretation. His kingdom is not going to last forever. And he figures, let me knock Daniel down. Let me make him into an idol. Let me throw some pride into him. And then I'll cause him to sin. And he orders Daniel dressed with the most royal clothing and to be established as the great advisor of Babylon. And Daniel asks that his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, remember their names were changed to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they should be with him to advise the king. Nebuchadnezzar asks himself, what am I going to do? I don't like this. This whole idea that the Jews will ultimately have a Messiah, this is where the world's headed, I don't want that. So what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He establishes a huge idol in the valley of Dura, a valley where there are bones strewn all over the valley, the dry bones of Jews who dared rebel against the king. And he orders all his people to gather to that valley of Dura, and he ensures that all the Jews are there. And he has a burning furnace that's so hot, took 3 days to heat it up. You couldn't even approach the furnace. He has it burning where everyone could see this burning furnace. And he announces, we're going to play the music. And when we play the music, everyone's going to bow to this huge idol. And whoever doesn't bow to the idol is being thrown into that furnace. Ready? They have this huge idol. They're standing in front of the idol. Just the foundation of the idol was a few blocks long to hold up such a huge idol. And they play the music. What's his thoughts? Let me make the Jewish people sin. Let me make their God hate them. And then I will ensure that the end of my dream won't come true. Nebuchadnezzar was right. He was on the right path. That's what Bilam did. Bilam said, if you want the Jewish people down, make them sin. And the whole book of Esther is an outgrowth of what Nebuchadnezzar did. Because the Jewish people all bowed to this idol, that's why God allowed the decree of Haman to come to be signed, to be sealed. So everyone bows except for three. You know who? Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, right? Those three, they don't bow. Daniel is exempt from this whole procession because you're not going to force your chief advisor to be there. So Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are called before the king. And the king says, I warned you that if you don't bow when we play the music, then you're going to be thrown into the furnace. Now I'm going to give you one more chance. And who's the God that's going to save you from me? So Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah say, Your Honor, you could play the music again and we're not going to bow. There's a God in heaven and He's the only one we bow to. And He could save us and He might not save us. But at the end of the day, He could save us from that furnace. So we're not going to bow to this idol, which is a lie. We are faithful to the God in heaven. And they answer this in front of everyone. And Nebuchadnezzar is furious. That's the exact opposite of what he wanted. So he has the three men thrown in. He orders his guards. They grab them. They approach the furnace. And these huge guards throw them in. And the fire leaps out and kills all the guards that brought them to the furnace. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, an angel comes down, the same angel that came down to kill all of the Assyrian soldiers, that same angel comes down and accompanies them in the fire, and nothing happens to them. Their clothes don't get burnt. The only thing that gets burnt are the ropes that were tying their hands. That gets burnt, and they're free, and they walk around in the furnace, and nothing's happening to them. And Nebuchadnezzar calls his men. He says, you see what's going on there? So his men say, yeah. He says, how many people do you see there? They say, we see four. He says, yeah, I know, but the fourth one I know. That's the angel I saw walking around and killing all the men of the Assyrian Empire back when I was a soldier. So Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are in the furnace. Nebuchadnezzar calls them and says, come out. They weren't going to come out till he told them. They come out and everyone runs over to them to check. What do they have on them? Did they smear some oil? What did they do? How did they do that? They smell the clothing. They want to see. Do they smell a fire? Nothing. So Nebuchadnezzar is blown away. What's he supposed to say? They had this great miracle. And Nebuchadnezzar appoints them to have high positions in the city of Babel. We should add two more stories in the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar writes a letter. That's the next chapter in the book of Daniel. He writes a letter to his people. And that's what's quoted in the continuation of the story, his letter. And he says he had a dream and he called in all the wise men to tell him the solution. No one could tell him until Daniel. And then he tells him what was the dream? What was the solution? And he says, you saw, so he tells him, when I was in bed, I saw a huge tree. All the birds and animals enjoyed that tree. Birds lived in its branches and animals stayed in its shade. And then an angel came down from heaven and said, cut down the tree. No one should live under this tree. No one should enjoy the tree anymore. But make sure the roots stay in the ground. Encase the roots to ensure that they don't go. And that's, well, that's my dream. What's the interpretation? So Daniel tells him the interpretation is, you're going to go crazy. You are that tree. That tree is a vision of you. And you're going to go out of your mind. And you're going to lose your whole kingdom because you're going to go crazy. And then eventually you'll come back and have it. But it'll take, you'll have 7 periods, 7 years, in which you're going to be running around like a wild animal. And if you want my advice, give charity. So long as you give charity, you'll delay the decree. So Nebuchadnezzar orders his kitchen to become a soup kitchen. He's giving out free food. He's helping out all the poor. And one day he's walking on his rooftop and he hears all the poor and he says, what's that? They tell him, oh, that's a long line of poor that come to your palace every day to get food. So he says, me, the great king Nebuchadnezzar, that's what I'm spending all my wealth for. Go tell him to stop. And he says that and boom, decree comes out of heaven. He goes crazy. He gets undressed. He starts running in the forest. And as he's doing this, one part of him realizes what's happening. Now, there was a not nice part of the story I skipped for a second. When Nebuchadnezzar would capture a king, he would rape him. That's what Nebuchadnezzar did to Tzidkiyahu too. Other kings would serve their captives with certain dignity because there was a certain courtesy they'd give one another because every king knew that one day he might be captured. The only king who didn't do that was Nebuchadnezzar. He would never release a king. He would show no courtesy. He said, I'm scared of no one. No one's ever capturing me. So now Nebuchadnezzar is running in the fields. He runs out to the forest. He's running naked and everyone sees him going crazy. He starts going on all fours and he's running through the forest and he starts jumping on other animals and other animals jump on him and he spends the next 7 years of his life running around naked in forests. His skin goes thick. He starts growing thick hair. He starts running around like an animal. And the same thing he did to the kings, the animals do to him. And for 7 years, he's running around like this. Until, at the end of the 7 years, he raises his eyes to heaven. And his sanity is returned. He says, at the end of the days, I raised my eyes to heaven. And then my sanity returned. And I blessed the Holy One, blessed be He. So this is all in a letter that Nebuchadnezzar sends the people. He tells them this whole story. And he praises Hashem and he orders that everyone respect Hashem. Now, Nebuchadnezzar dies. And what happens when Nebuchadnezzar comes back to his throne after he regains his sanity, before he dies. So he spends 7 years running around insane. And then he comes back to his throne and he finds his son Belshazzar took the throne. What were they supposed to do? 7 years he's gone. So he throws him into jail. He finds his son Belshazzar let Tzidkiyahu out of jail. So he rebukes him and punishes him for doing all of that. So when Nebuchadnezzar finally dies, Belshazzar is appointed as king and Belshazzar orders his father's body taken out of the grave. He says, I want to see him dead before I take the throne. After everything he suffered the first time. So Belshazzar becomes king. And Belshazzar really takes Tzidkiyahu out of prison. He treats him fairly, like kings would be treated. And he gives him food and he takes care of him. And that's how Tzidkiyahu ends his days. Tzidkiyahu passes away in peace. But Belshazzar has a dream of four wild animals, which also is interpreted as the four kingdoms that would rule the earth. Daniel interprets it. And in his third year, Belshazzar has a war with the Persian Mede Empire. And that's our lead in to the story of Esther, which we'll get to in a second. Yes?
I have a couple of questions, but the most recent one, is this the same Belshazzar who is Daniel?
No. They had a similar name, but no.
Okay, fine. He said that the Jews were punished, Haman was allowed to have his way initially because of what they did under way back, under the Babylonians. not because of the classic, you know, how they were assimilated and went to the banquet and did things other than things.
Two opinions in the Talmud. So I felt everyone knows that one. You guys should know the other one.
Okay.
Well, I figure my job is to tell you what you don't know, right? That one everyone knows.
Did Ezra make a mistake when he said, or I guess it sounds like it was implied, you know, since there's so much, such a Torah empire in Babel?
No. Chazal say that Limud Torah, learning Torah, is more important than going up to Israel, even when it means rebuilding the temple. So Ezra, so long as it's Rebbe Baruch ben Neriah, the disciple of the prophet Jeremiah, Baruch ben Neriah, so long as he was alive in Babylon, and he was too old to make the trek up to Israel, so long as he was alive, Ezra stayed in Babylon and learned by him.
Did Ezra end up making Aliyah?
Yeah, after that, after his Rebbe died. Then he went and he led the rebuilding of the Second Temple, sure. Now Ezra was a giant, we learned about him Thursday night. As big as Moshe Rabbeinu, right? The Torah was fit to be given by Ezra. So, Belshazzar has a war with the Persian Mede Empire. This is the third year of Belshazzar's reign. And they have a very pivotal battle, which he wins. And just like Nebuchadnezzar was obsessed with this idea that the empire would ultimately be taken by the Jews, so too was Belshazzar. And many kings thereafter were obsessed with the idea. As we will see, so was Ahasuerus. So what Belshazzar wants to figure out is, when is redemption supposed to come? God told the Jews, after 70 years, he'll take them back. So Belshazzar sits down and does the calculations. And Belshazzar figures the 70 years were up last year. And they weren't redeemed. So we won. My dad succeeded. They sinned and God hates them. And he's never taken them back. And maybe the Babylonian Empire will continue being the world empire forever. So that night, after Belshazzar is victorious in his war against the Persian Mede Empire, he's feeling super powerful. He orders the vessels of the temple taken out. He has a huge party. And at the party, he orders to take out the temple's vessels, which were the finest vessels that King Solomon brought in, the finest gold. No one in the world had such beautiful vessels. So to celebrate the great victory and show his men, look at what a powerful empire we are, he takes out the vessels of the temple. And they're sitting at the party, everyone's drinking, even their dogs were given gold vessels from the temple to drink from. And Belshazzar is sitting there at the party drinking. And he drinks cheers with 1,000 men, meaning he drank 1,000 goblets of wine that night. And he didn't go drunk, and he held his liquor. He had a big stomach. So after 1,000 shots of wine and sitting there celebrating with his men, they didn't win the war, they only won the battle. Suddenly a hand appears and starts writing on the wall. And there's a lamp right next to the wall, and everyone sees a hand. And suddenly there's silence throughout the banquet. Everyone walks up to watch what's going on here. A heavenly hand appears and starts writing on the wall. And it writes, and it writes, and it stops and disappears. And Belshazzar stands there, and as the book describes, his knees start shaking, and his jaw drops, and he's standing there filled with fear. What's going on here? He orders all his wise men brought in and asks them, whoa, what's written on the wall? No one could read the writing. This is the new writing. This is the Assyrian script which we have in our Sifrei Torah. This is the writing that was given in Moshe Rabbeinu's time, but that people forgot during the course of the exile and as time passed. So even the Jews sitting at the banquet, no one could understand the writing on the wall. They're all looking and trying to read it, and they can't read it. It was also written going down. It was written like Chinese letters, going down. And they were trying to read it across. No one could figure out what it reads. And finally, his wife walks in and says, "Hey, your dad had a great advisor." It was his mother. Says, "Hey, your dad had a great advisor named Daniel. Why don't you call him in?" They call in Daniel. And Daniel reads the writing on the wall. Now you know where that saying comes from. Read the writing on the wall. Daniel tells him, Mene, tekel uparsin. The writing on the wall says, Mene, God counted you, and your time is up. Your kingship is over. Tekel, you have been weighed in the scales of heaven, and you have been found wanting. Parson, that has a dual meaning. Parson means to break up. Parson is a reference to the Persian Mede Empire, which is going to win you. You're finished. And Belshazzar, after he sees that Daniel could figure it out, he orders them to give Daniel royal clothes, royal purple, a golden chain on his neck, and they give him 1/3 of the kingdom he should rule over, and Belshazzar goes to sleep very worried. So he leaves an order with his men. If you see anyone walking around here tonight, you kill him. No one's allowed to walk in the palace tonight. And then Belshazzar himself has to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night. So Belshazzar walks out of his room and the guards kill him. And the guard that kills him sees he killed the king. And he says, ooh, this is what Daniel said would happen tonight. He grabs Belshazzar's head and goes over to the Persian Mede Empire in the middle of the night. And he tells them, look, you guys, you can have it. The party is still going on downstairs. Everyone's partying and eating and drinking and singing. And in the middle of the party, suddenly they hear word they're being attacked. The Persian Mede Empire is attacking again. The middle of the night. In those days, no one attacked in the middle of the night. But they knew that Belshazzar was dead. So they, in that night, they overtook the whole Babylonian Empire. The Persian Mede Empire in one night won the war. And when they took over the empire, they made a deal that the Persians and Medes would divide the kingship. The first king would be Mede king, Dariovish the Mede. And then the next king would be a Persian king. Whoever was king, the second in command was from the other nation. So that was their partnership. And then when the Persian Mede Empire takes over, so you have Darius. And in the first year of Darius, Daniel thinks that the 70 years are up. So Daniel starts doing the calculations and he says, God, you told us after 70 years you're taking us back. According to my calculations, the 70 years are up this year. And he doesn't understand why redemption hasn't come. So he prays, and that's later on in the book of Daniel where an angel comes and explains to him when the redemption was meant to come now and when the future redemption would come. And that's why the book of Daniel is not translated. Oh, they translated it, but they don't know what they translated. A real traditional translation was banned. Meaning there were rabbis who had a tradition how to understand the verses of Daniel to understand when redemption would come in the time of the Second Temple. But Daniel was told by the angel, hide it. And so that's why the rabbis never authorized a publication of a real traditional translation of Daniel. We could read the verses, but you'll see the verses say after a time and a time and a half a time. What does that mean? What's a time and a half a time? What's it talking about? You'll see the verses in Daniel are very unclear unless you know what they're talking about. So Daniel is told when it will come. And the next year there is a king of Koresh, the Persian. And he tells the Jews, you can go up and rebuild your temple. I'll give you money, I'll give you what you need. Go start rebuilding your temple. And the Jews go. And the temple is not built throughout Koresh. And then they send word back to Koresh that the Jews, if they're allowed to rebuild the temple, they will rebel against them. They are fortifying the city of Jerusalem as they're building in order to rebel once again. And they have a history of rebelling. So Koresh says, oh yeah? Now, who sends him that letter? Who sends him that letter the Jews are planning to rebel? A man by the name of Shimshi ben Haman. Haman's son named Shimshi. He has a son named Shimshi. And he sends Haman the word. He sends the word, working with his father Haman. He tells Koresh, the Jews are preparing a rebellion. You can't let them build this temple. And so Koresh stops the building of the temple. And he orders a decree by Persian law, no letting the Jews rebuild the temple. And after his reign, we come to his stable boy. There was a kid who was in charge of the stable. He's known as Achshverosh. And we have two approaches in our sages to Achshverosh. One approach says he was brilliant. Went from being a stable boy all the way to being king. The other approach says he wasn't brilliant at all. He just was lucky, but he was pretty stupid. So Achashverosh marries the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? What?
How did he manage that as a stable?
I don't know.
Military. He was a military.
He was in the military.
Yeah, he was around during the
don't
no. No, I'm asking that. I'm asking about. I think there's something. I mean, that's a good question. You go from here to here. You had to have done something.
I don't know.
I mean, didn't they kill the Babylonian men and they took the women as to sort of give themselves interest or whatever? Took themselves the royal women. Vashti was the. I
sounds familiar what you're saying, but I don't remember.
But that's what
because this question is fair.
That was when he was a stable boy.
Somewhere between the stable boy and the
he was a king at the time.
Babylonians, he must have done something.
So he did become very wealthy, and he liked money. And Vashti was one of the most beautiful women in world history, the Talmud says. So he marries Vashti. And Vashti was unusual because they were in the Persian Mede Empire, and every empire has their looks, and Vashti was different because she came from Babylon. So he goes back to the Persian Mede Empire with Vashti, and he manages to make his way to the throne through wealth, through buying his way in. He comes in. And one of the things that interests him, just like it interested Belshazzar, is that the temple will not be rebuilt. And he sits down and does the calculations a third time to figure out when are the 70 years up. The prophet Jeremiah was the only true prophet they knew of. Because all the soothsayers, all the sorcerers, all the pagans of Israel were telling the people, don't worry, God's on our side. We're never going to lose this temple. We're never going to lose the wars. The only one who stood up was Jeremiah and the other true prophets. But he was the famous one. So everyone knew of Jeremiah, and Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, kept telling the people, hold on to your deeds, because in 70 years you're coming back. So everyone wanted to know, have the Jews sinned enough that God's given up on them? And Ahasuerus sits down and does his own calculations of the 70 years, and he figures the 70 years are up by the second year of his reign. And when the Jews aren't brought in, when the Jews aren't allowed to go back and rebuild the temple, Ahasuerus is confident they're done with. Notice how this story keeps repeating itself. First Nebuchadnezzar, then Belshazzar, and finally Ahasuerus thinks, if the 70 years are up and they're not being called back, then I can do whatever I want with them. And so our Megillah begins with Ahasuerus rejoicing the fact that the threat of the Jews is gone. Remember, everyone's worried because of Nebuchadnezzar's first dream. His dream that ultimately the Jews would take the throne. So Ahasuerus is also rejoicing. And Ahasuerus figures, we're going to make a party, and we're going to bring the Jews down a notch, the same way Bilam did. What did Bilam do to bring the Jews down? Who remembers?
He
enticed them with women. So Ahasuerus is setting up this party with movable curtains, with movable borders between the men and women section. And the idea is that at the end of the party, there's going to be mixed dancing, and they're going to mix, and there's going to be massive promiscuity going on openly, and they'll be able to seduce the Jews to participate.
Long party, too.
What? Long party, yeah. So, it is Ahasuerus, and here we begin our Megillah. It is the third year of Ahasuerus's reign, and he is feeling comfortable on the throne. He feels like, okay, no one's rebelling against me, I'm okay. And he makes a party, calling in all the officers and soldiers, and he wants to show his wealth, he wants to show his might, and he makes a party for 180 days. What's he doing? You're calling in all the soldiers and all the officers, what are you doing?
Solidifying power.
Ah, solidifying power, showing them that their time is worthless in his eyes. They could take 180 days, that's a half a year. A half a year off to party in his palace. There were kings in world history who did this. They'd ensure that their nobles were always in their castle having parties, and this was a way to ensure they weren't plotting against them. They weren't out there amassing armies against them. So one of the great things Ahasuerus does, and that the Persian Mede Empire did, was they laid infrastructure. And that's what we're going to see throughout the Megillah, that they had they laid roads throughout the desert. And they had speed camels where they could communicate. And this was pivotal for him to control such a large empire. He needed an infrastructure to get information, to understand what's going on everywhere. So Ahasuerus calls in all his officers and all the army, and he makes this lavish party for a half a year. And every day there's a new thrill. No 2 days could be alike. And at the end of the party, he calls in the people of Shushan, the capital, invites them for a 7-day party. And initially he thinks that one hall is going to be enough, and then he has to expand to a second hall, and then to a third hall. And he's taking them throughout his wealth. And again, he's making a lavish party. Now the Jews of Shushan, they have a lot of gratitude to show the Persian Mede Empire. The history books show that when the Persian Empire took over the Babylonian Empire, they released all the slaves. One of the rules that the Persian Mede Empire instituted was a rule of equality. So the Jews were very thankful. Here they were released from slavery. The Babylonians had sold them into slavery. And now under the Persian Mede Empire, they were getting such good treatment. So everyone felt pressure to come to the party. And Achashverosh sent messengers to Mordechai and said, I hear you're the chief rabbi of the Jews. Tell me what hechsher is good for you. Tell me how I could have an Orthodox cook working the kitchen so that you have the meat that makes the Jews happy. So Achashverosh is ensuring that the meat and the wine and everything is kosher. It's like those hotels. They advertise everything's kosher, but the atmosphere is not kosher. What's going on there isn't kosher. The food's kosher, but everything else isn't kosher. So that's what's going on here. Achashverosh calls up Mordechai and says, tell me what to do. But Mordechai goes to Shul and tells the people, no, go. You guys can't go. But they don't listen to him. Some do, and most don't. They want to be good citizens. So they're drinking. And the Persian custom was they'd have this huge goblet. And they'd pass it around. And every person that got the goblet was forced to finish the whole goblet of wine. Every person that got a drink was asked, how old are you? And whatever age you were, they'd bring you a wine that was older, that was from before when you were born. This was a sign of wealth. Achashverosh was telling everyone, I'm better than all of you. Achashverosh would take people into his treasuries, every day into another treasury. 180 days. He had so many treasuries. He had over 180 treasuries to show them. And he's showing them, well, however old you are, I got something better than you. He orders Vashti to come. And you guys already learned the Malbim's pshat, right? He's trying to show the people, I only married her for her beauty. Chazal, tell us what happens here. It's Shabbos. What do we do when we sit on Shabbos? We sing songs of praise to Hashem. That's the Zmiros. What does a guy do like Achashverosh? What's he got to talk about? They start talking about women. So each one starts talking about the women of his city. And here you see the politicians knew very well who were the beautiful women of their city. Each one starts talking about the women in their city, how beautiful they are. And Achashverosh says, anything you Persian Medes have seen is nothing like what I got. So they're all drunk. They say, show us. So Achashverosh sends word to Vashti and says, come on out with your crown on and nothing else. And Vashti sends word back, you know, my dad drank 1,000 cups of wine. I'm sorry, she was the daughter of Belshazzar. She was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. My dad drank cheers with 1,000 people and didn't go drunk. And you're drunk so quickly? Who are you, you stable boy? You're telling me to walk out with the crown alone. This isn't what Achashverosh wanted. This wasn't part of the plan. Yes?
I heard in the Midrash that says she would have been more than happy to do so because that's like the kind of woman she was. But the only reason she did is because She
didn't
not so nicely with young Jewish girls, and so God punished her by giving her like a skin disease. And
right.
So she couldn't show herself off like she actually wanted to.
I like that, Yaakov. Well, I like your virtue better. Excuse
me. That's what the Medrash says, right? So the Medrash says, right, the Vashti got covered with pimples. She broke out, getting very nervous. Achashverosh invites her and she sees she's not going to make it. There's even a medrash that says she got a tail that day.
Why would a woman really, though, of her background? I mean, your explanation sounds so much more plausible. I got to say that.
Yeah, but you guys have to know the medrashim too, okay?
It's possible that both.
It's like, very hard.
Of course, it's possible.
She pretends to be like,
things
like,
about you. Absolutely. Totally taken in by him and forgot about her. It's possible.
I'll tell you. I it's very challenging because I'm always at odds with myself. You have to know the midrashim that every kid knows. Your kids are going to come home with these midrashim. You have to know them. But you also have to know the gemaros and the things that on your level is what I would give you. Saying, but you have to know both. So I'm assuming that in the other classes you're getting the midrashim that you have to know, like you quoted. And I got to fill in with the other sources. So Achashverosh is drunk and upset. And he turns to the Jews. He says, okay, rabbis, tell me what am I supposed to do now? And the rabbis convene and they say, there's a problem. She deserves the death penalty. But he's going to wake up the morning after and he's going to be very upset at whoever gave him that counsel to kill her. So what are we supposed to answer him? Now this is a very smart thing. Very often when it's election season, you see this. People go all out against one candidate and they never think about the fact that there's going to be the morning after elections. What are you going to do with him the day after? You have to sit in the same government or the same council. What are you going to do the next morning? How are you going to look at a guy that you spoke about that way? Yeah, so we have to... you have to work with him afterwards. You got to be careful what you say. I wrote an article before the elections this year with just that thought. I said, just remember, these people at the end of the day are going to be your representatives. As much as you feel badly about one, be careful what you say. We had elections in our yeshuva. All the yeshuvim had elections, the councils. So I said, you know, Lashon Hara isn't permitted just because it's election season. And aside from that, you're going to have to deal with the day after and the day after that. Elections end one day and then you got to deal the next 4 years. So that's what the tribe of Yisachar, the wise men that he asks, that's what they figure. How are we going to deal with him when he's sober? He's going to come back and he's going to be pretty upset. So they tell him, look, we've been taken out of our land. We can't rule on matters of life and death. This is a very heavy case. We're not smart enough. And so they shift them. They say, go talk to the other nations that haven't been exiled. They'll have their wise men. They'll give you good advice. So he has a bunch of wise men. The smallest one is Mimuchon, which according to tradition, one interpretation says that that was Haman. So he's quick to talk before everyone else. And he says... if everyone hears what Vashti said, so then they'll all look down at their husbands. They'll all look down at their husbands. What does that sound like? Isn't that interesting? We need your backing that our wives will look up to us. So that shows something about their marriages. You see, they all backed his... they backed his advice. They backed his counsel. So when they're drunk... they're all thinking, our wives are not going to look up to us. In Josephus, it says that at one point, the king was sleeping, and his advisors, this goes back to the time of Nebuchadnezzar, the advisors challenged one another. They said, let's ask a riddle, and whoever gives the best answer will be the top advisor to the king. So they asked a riddle, what's the strongest thing on the planet? So one said, the king, and another one said, a lion. And Daniel said, I'm making it up, I don't remember what they each said. But Daniel finally said, the woman. So each one had, when the king woke up, so each one had to justify their position to the king. So each one tried to justify their position to the king. And then Daniel said, of course the woman's the most powerful thing on the planet. Because even the great king, when he goes out to war, and everything he conquers, what does he do? He comes back home and spreads out his spoils in front of his wife and shows him and waits for her to say, what a great job he did. So you see, she's the most powerful one. At the end of the day, all his wars he brings back and shows her. So it's interesting that that's when Mimuchan tells them, we're all in danger, all our wives, what are they going to say? They all agree, they all nod. Uh-huh. And in their drunken stupor, they tell Achashverosh, have her killed. So it doesn't say it overtly in the Megillah. Again, remember, Mordechai has to be politically astute in the way he's wording the Megillah. So a lot of things are said in the Megillah, if you read with sensitivity, if you read the words, you'll see that he's saying a lot. But overtly, what does he say? That she should be removed. It doesn't say what, how she should be removed. Her kingdom should be given to a friend who's better than hers. Better than her. And then everyone will respect their wives. So everyone says, great idea. And Vashti is hung. And they send out word that every man is boss in the house. Now you have to remember, these were the days when men would beat up their wives. Seriously. It says that people got this letter and said, she doesn't dare open her mouth to me. I need the king to tell me I'm the boss in the house. This man's crazy. These were the days where if a woman said something her husband didn't like, he'd beat her. There wasn't two ways about it. A woman had no rights in those days. She couldn't take her husband to court. There was no such thing as woman's rights. So the average gardener who got Ahasuerus's letter looked at it and said, what a drunk, what a fool. We got a crazy king up there at the helm. So this is part of the backdrop to the scene of our story, where the people are getting a feeling we have a king who cannot be relied upon. He is unstable. He killed his own wife. Who knows what he could do next? And that's where people are going to be very scared to act on the decree. This will ultimately save us. Because when he gives the decree, there's a pogrom pending. In 11 months, you could kill all the Jews. Why didn't they jump on the bandwagon and just do it then? Because they saw if he could kill his wife, he could kill anyone. And they realized if he told us we on this day we could kill the Jews, we better wait till that day. Because there's no telling what he can do. And that's what saved us in the end. Because we needed that time for Mordechai and Esther to get their act together and get him to repeal the decree. So Ahasuerus sends out the word. He has Vashti executed, and he regains his sobriety. How do you say it?
Sobriety.
He starts asking, "Where's Vashti?" So they tell him she's dead, and he says, well, how's she dead? So they say, you killed her. I killed her. When did I kill her? At the party last night. She did this. She did that. And Ahasuerus is very upset. And his advisors are scared of walking into his chambers. They're the ones who told him to kill her. So now you have a situation where the king has no advisors. The only people advising him are the little lads who are there to serve him. The advisors are keeping a distance. And they give him very bad advice. The first piece of advice they tell him is gather every good-looking girl into Shushan. Now that's a sure way to win enemies. Send out your men and let them gather from every city across your kingdom, every good-looking girl, and she's going to sit in captivity in your harem, and you'll have a girl a night, and then after all this time that they're preparing to see if they're fit to be queen, so then you'll choose whoever you like, and you'll have a good queen instead of Vashti. And Ahasuerus, being the intelligent dude he was, says, great idea. And he orders his men out, and they start summoning girls from every town. People started hiding their daughters. You had a situation where people were hiding their girls from the officials, including an old man named Mordechai, who has a girl in her 70s named Esther, who's living by him. When she was a baby and they were exiled, they were exiled already. Back in the exile, oh, you didn't think of Esther as a 70-year-old, your grandma, right? Okay, so it says that they were all exiled with Yechoniah. 70 years have passed since the exile of Yechoniah. Remember, we said Yechoniah was exiled before the destruction, remember? Let's go back to our story. Jehoiakim was killed, remember? And we had the third year, he conquered, on the eighth year, he conquered Jehoiakim, killed him, established his son Jehoiachin, and in the ninth year he came back and exiled Jehoiachin. So in the ninth year of his reign, a decade before the exile, he exiles Jehoiachin. This was 70 years ago. And that's when Mordechai and Esther came out to Persia with all the great leaders, remember? That exile of Jehoiachin. So now Esther's an old lady. And she's been brought up as an orphan by her uncle Mordechai. And she chose to marry him later. And now Mordechai comes to the scene with his daughter, with his wife, niece, who he hides so that Ahasuerus' men won't get their claws on her. But it doesn't work, as we shall see. Yes?
What does Mordechai mean?
Ooh. Can't tell you that yet. Mordechai means pure. Dachi means pure. And mor is a type of spice. Mordechai means Mordechi. That's why Rav Avadya always calls him Mordechi, because mor is a spice and dechi means pure.
So it's not light.
Right. Okay, and this is where we'll pick up Ezachem Wednesday night.